Good morning, 7:41 here on the Mighty 690. It is Wednesday, and that means we are joined by the folks from K State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And joining us in studio, we have Crop Agent James Coover. Good morning, James.
Hey, good morning.
Good to have you on here. Yeah, so, thanks. One more day of the kind of warmer weather, and then spring like weather.
Back into winter fall here.
That's right. And that's a cool Kansas hat. I'm a little envious of that.
Oh
one.
yeah, you know, gotta represent here.
I like that. I like that. That's neat. So yeah, we're getting in here, and I know you've got an event you want to tell us about to start off.
So I have an event coming up here in Montgomery County, actually, and so this will be agronomy night. It's something that has been going on for a very long time now, even before I started, years and years. Agronomy night has been a tradition in Montgomery County. This year we're going to have it on December the 5th at the ICC West Building community room, where I usually have this. It will start at 5:30. The actual program will start at 6. This year we're going to do a little different. And so usually I have some speakers come in. They talk about some agronomy subject or another. This year we're going to play trivia. And so if farmers want to come and test their trivia knowledge for a chance to win prizes from local ag businesses, please, give us a call and sign up. It'll be a really fun night. And I think farmers will like that, the little change in pace. And so we're going to have a fun evening for agronomy.
Well, that is fun, to be able to show off your talents there. So, yeah, it is. Trivia night is always fun. So very good. Well, hey, I'd just been walking around yesterday and, noticed the soybean field that was all nice and dry, getting ready for harvest probably. So how are things looking out there crop-wise?
So for the most part, I mean, a lot of our wheat, and some farmers are still putting some wheat in. It's a little late, but that's okay. Here in Southeast Kansas, we can put in wheat this late and be fine. The soybeans, it seems like how are they this late, like getting harvested? A lot of people think that. But I tell you, a lot of those soybeans are still just about not quite dry enough to harvest. It doesn't seem like that, but when it gets cool like this, they just slow down a lot on their drying down process. And so, yeah, a lot of them, I mean, they're still getting harvested. And we'll be harvesting all the way up till Thanksgiving. That's very common here in Southeast Kansas. But our wheat looks pretty good. I mean, it got a little dry there for a little bit, but then we got some more rain. So I'd say, I don't know, there's some spottiness to it, but not too bad, honestly, right now. I mean, the soil's just, there's no excess moisture at all, which is odd for this part of Kansas this time of year. But we have just enough to keep things going for right now.
All right. Well, we'll keep piecing it along as we go here. So I know you wanted to talk a little bit related to the soil, speaking of, soil moisture and that sort of thing. So where do you want to start off with the topic of, soil sampling and all this good stuff?
Yes, I know this is something I've talked about a lot, being a soil, chemist, agronomist, I say a lot of that stuff. But it's important. And this time of year is a very good time of year to do a lot of that soil sampling. And honestly, I get some soil samples in the extension office that aren't terribly taken correctly. And so I know it's something that I still kind of need to discuss from time to time, because the inaccuracy of a soil sample is basically nothing at all. In fact, it might even be worse than nothing, because then it's telling you something that's not true.
Well, and if we're going to do this, let's make sure we do it right. That way you're not wasting your time, because your time is valuable.
And the soil sample costs something too, and it does not take any more time. Actually, it takes less time to take an accurate sample than an inaccurate one, just because of how you do it. And so, first I'm going to talk about pastures, and then crops, and then gardens probably. So when you're taking one for a pasture, and Winnie probably has talked about this before, it's a little bit different in that the soil depth can be a little bit different. You could take a 3-6 or a 0-3 or a 3-6 soil sample. Basically, you're taking a surface sample that you're testing for pH, if you think that's going to be an issue. Otherwise, you take a 0-6 inch sample. And that's pretty important that you do this in at least 10 places around the field. This is universal. And so 10 samples at least per soil sample. Now, one thing that is kind of my opinion in that two things is that, first off, one sample can't really represent more than 40 to 50 acres. it's very hard for one soil sample to be more than that in a pasture situation. And the reason is because our pastures are just way too variable here in Southeast Kansas. I mean, it's not like, you know, other parts like the Flint Hills, for instance. It's a huge area. There's some variability, but for the most part, you can kind of predict where the variability is. Here in Southeast Kansas, we just have too much history here. Our fields are much smaller than that. They're up, they're down, their soil, you know, is all over the place. And so really, I would divide most pastures into at least 40 acres per sample. That way you really kind of have an idea of what's going on there. Also for pastures, you know, when you take those soil samples, you don't really need anything more complex than just the most basic stuff. And so pH, phosphorus, potassium, that works out pretty well, honestly. And so, you know, when you're doing this, no matter what really you're sampling, whether it's pastures, crops, or gardens, I always suggest using a soil probe. I have seen plenty of soil samples come in, and they come into with a big bucket. it's a literal 2-gallon bucket of soil. And like, I know that wasn't taken with a soil probe because there's no possible way that could be. So I was like, how was this taken? You know, like, was it just a hole dug out in the pasture? Which has some accuracy to it, but if you're getting a lot more soil from the surface, like the first couple of inches than you are from the bottom couple of inches of the soil profile, that is a very different kind of soil. All your phosphorus is in the top, most of your potassium, you know, and even your pH is going to be astronomically different between those two. But all of our indexes, all of our recommendations are based on that 0 to 6. So I give you recommendations, but I'm not ever quite secure about them, honestly. So I will give you recommendations on whatever sample is you bring into the office. But if you want a good one, please come and get a soil probe. In fact, if you're a producer, you should honestly have your own probe by now. They're kind of expensive because they're, you know, cast aluminum or steel or whatever they are. But for the most part, it's going to be worth it. And so, I mean, that $100 to $120 is well worth that soil probe because you should be using it a lot. And so, and considering you should be dividing your pastures into 40-acre segments at the most, there's going to be a lot of samples to be taking around your fields. So next up is crops. Pretty much the exact same situation. The soil samples are always, you know, pretty much the same. In no-till, it can be 0 to 3 and then 3 to 6. But for the most part, most crops are going to be taken on the 0 to 6 because that's our indexes. The only difference is that I wouldn't go anywhere over 20 to 30 acres when it comes to crops. Mostly, this has to do with money. Because we have so much more intensive fertilizer and pH and all that when it comes to crops, don't take a one sample for a 100-acre field. Because, yes, you can get it, but there's so much variability that if you're missing that, it's much more costly to miss it on a crop situation.
Well, and two, you know, we hear the word, you know, for the phrase precision agriculture thrown around a lot, and, you know, being able to target some of these fertilizers a little bit more effectively. I don't know how many people are actually really doing that per se, but, yeah. You know, we always, you know, the fertilizer is definitely going to be expensive, and, you know, you don't want to waste it on an area where you don't need it.
Yes, yeah, it is expensive, you know, and there's plenty of research out there. We've been doing it for decades at K-State that shows that, you know, where our indexes lie. Like, anything above this quantity within our soil isn't really going to have that much more yield. But anything below that is going to be kind of dramatic. And so, I mean, those soil samples are the very key, honestly, to the beginning of all of this stuff. And so, you know, and another thing about crops, there are a lot of guys that do the grid sampling. I mean, you know, 5-acre segments. And that's something, it is kind of pricey, honestly, to do an acre. I mean, do a field, but do, yeah, I mean, a lot of them have 1,000 acres or more. To do that for all those acres is prohibitive. So I've always said that if you would want to really know your soil correctly, you should do grid sampling probably every 8 to 10 years. And you do that right before you apply lime. That way, you know, because that's where the biggest bang for the buck it is for grid sampling. After that is when every 2 years, I mean, on your scale here, is when you divide everything out into your 20 to 30 acre segments. So that way you can watch your phosphorus and your potassium levels go up or down. You know your pH is mostly okay, but the other components you need to watch more carefully. And so that way, the expense isn't so great. And so you're not like going to be good sampling your all your 1,000 acres at once. You're going to be doing, you know, a few fields this year, a few fields next year. Every year you're going to be doing another grid sampling. Every year you're going to be doing another segment of your, you know, your management zone situation. And so, yeah, I know it's another thing, right? Like, farmers don't need yet another thing. And right now they're still harvesting soybeans and they've got some more, some of them are still putting some wheat in. But as soon as that done, the job's not done yet. You need to get ready for next year. And fall is usually the one of the best times to do that sampling, partly because of it's a chemical stability when it comes to the soil. And if you do those samplings at the same time of the year, your indexes aren't going to be so messed up. Basically, potassium. If you take your potassium sample in the fall and then in the spring, the summer, you could not have the exact same amount of potassium in the soil, but the index is going to look different. I don't know why soil does that. It's a lot more transient than what people realize.
Yeah, yeah.
Those chemicals are moving back and forth all the time. It's hard to tell. So just make sure you sample generally the same time of year. That way you can wash those indexes at the same point.
We're trying to control as many variables as possible.
Yeah, that's what it is. You're controlling a variable, and time is a variable when it comes to soil. And so lastly, I guess that kind of comes down to gardens. Gardens are different, obviously. I mean, it's a field, but a much smaller field. So very similar to a crop sample, most of them are going to be taken to the 0 to 6. You want to test every spot that's different. And so gardens are non-homogeneous, honestly, because people put compost on one side or they do something here and do something there. It can be hard to take a sample of every different spot. But just generally, if something has been treated very differently, take a different sample. And that's the same thing with yards, same things with other things. I mean, the front yard and the backyard is very different. The soil around your house, like if it's within 5-10 feet from your house, is going to be very different because when your house was put in, they dug all that soil up. It's foundation dirt. It's not as good. So just make sure that you divvy stuff out when it comes to around your house. I mean, honestly, around your house, you probably have 5 or 6 different soils. Even just a normal house on a normal lot in any town, there's probably 5 or 6 different samples that you need to take there to really understand what you're working with. Most people, they don't really care about their yard too much, you know? Like, there's some grass out there, Bermuda, fescue. But you're going to put a lot of work into your flower beds. And so taking that $11 sample is really not that bad. Honestly, and there are plenty of soil samples that come in from gardens that have vastly too much in it. All right, like they have been composted for way too long. I mean, you know, it's good. Compost makes everything nice and fluffy. It's good stuff. But I mean, we've seen phosphorus results that are above 1,000 parts per million. And to give some context, anything above 30 is high. Wow. So 1,000 is astronomical.
That
it's like, you know, no person will ever need to put phosphorus in that spot ever again. And that's the same thing with, I mean, the potassium levels are astronomically high. You know, the organic matter can sometimes be 8-9%. At that point, putting any more on there will be detrimental to whatever you're growing.
Gotcha.
So you can go too far.
Now, something of this particular concern, maybe to some of the folks here in Southeast Kansas, is the lead content that we can find in the soil too.
Yes, and so this is not meant to be alarmist in any way, shape, or form, but Southeast Kansas has a history of lead mining and zinc mining, and that dug up a lot of lead. And you know, back in the 40s and 50s, when that stuff was being mined, they weren't terribly careful with it, and they spread that stuff everywhere. So it's like glitter. It just went everywhere, and you know, it's almost impossible to clean up. You know, in Cherryville, for instance, they've done a lot of that. That's where the old battery plant used to be, or whatever it is.
Yeah, smelting.
Of that lead, and it got lead everywhere, which is why a lot of places in Cherryville, the EPA come and they hired some company to dig those yards up. I mean, a lot of that lead is still around there. And so, you know, but Cherryville's not the only place. There's plenty of other towns here in southeast Kansas, even along the railroads, where lead just kind of got sloshed here and there, honestly. So if you are in a place, this isn't majority, all right? But if you're in a place where there is a possibility of lead contamination, basically you're in some urban environment, maybe there was a history of lead smelting or a railroad nearby or even some oil refinery back in the day when they used to put lead in the gasoline. Mm-hmm. Anymore, like here in Coffeyville, that's not really a concern because that's not something they deal with anymore. But, you know, if there's some sort of past to that, it's a possibility that you might want to test your garden for lead as well. Or if you have some kids that like to play outside in the dirt, dirt is a very good way for kids to get a hold of lead because they're playing in that dirt, they get it in their mouths, they track it inside the house, you know, then the dust inside your house has lead in it too. And so it would be surprising, and I'm not an epidemiologist, so I'm not going to speak on this at all, but I think people would be surprised how many kids in southeast Kansas has elevated lead levels. And so it's a subject for a different agent.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Yeah. No, we could have a whole topic on it. But yeah, especially those folks a little bit closer to the Tri-State Mining District and the chat piles that are still there. I mean, yeah, it's just, yeah, it's pretty yeah. crazy.
And so there is lead around. And if you're considering it, if it's a garden that you have some sort of contact with the soil and there's a lead concern, that is something that we can test for.
Sure. So if people do want to get a soil sample taken, bring it into you, what's the easiest way to do that?
Well, first, you need to come and borrow a soil probe, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's the only good way of taking one. There are other ways if you are very, very careful, but please come get a soil probe. So you come get a soil probe, you take your sample, which is 10 cores, 6 inches deep. It's really fast. Then just put it in a Ziploc bag, bring it right back into the extension office, and we'll mail it off for you and get you results.
All right. Very easy. So, and James Cooper, appreciate you coming on by.
Yeah, of course.
All righty. Okay. And coming up here in just a few minutes, we are going to be talking with Jesse Gilmore, the horticulture agent for the Extension District. So that is on the way. 66 degrees right now in Coffeyville as we head towards 8 o'clock. Check the news coming up here on the Mighty 690. 810 here on the Mighty 690, and we are joined once again by James Coover. And joining us now on the line, we have Jesse Gilmore from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. Jesse's a horticulture agent. Good morning, Jesse. How are you doing?
Doing pretty good. Still not quite used to the time change.
I don't think anyone is. I just still kind of garbage in my opinion, but hey, it's it is what it is.
I was going to say, I'm probably not alone there.
No, I don't think anyone. I actually haven't talked to anyone who actually says they like it. And then the two, this misconception that it's like the farmers are for it or something, like, I don't even know where that came from. It's just made up.
Yeah, it's definitely less useful than it used to be, I think.
Yeah, well, hey, we have been talking here a little bit this past segment about soil sampling and that sort of thing with James, but I know you're going to give us just a little bit of kind of a crash course in soil science because, you know, this is one of those things this time of year we should definitely be thinking about.
Yeah, so management of your soil is going to be the single biggest factor in how successfully your plants grow. Or how successfully your plants grow. And it's really good that James was talking about soil sampling so that I don't have to circle back around to it because there is a lot that goes into management of your soil. And soil was definitely my favorite thing to learn about when I was at K-State because before I started taking classes on soil science, and soil chemistry, and soil physics, surprisingly, I always thought that dirt was dirt, and it's super simple, and like, oh, how much do I need to know about dirt? It is such a complex system. But really, when you're talking about soil management, it boils down to four things. Really, three and a half things, because there's not much you can do about the fourth thing. That's going to be your soil geology, your soil chemistry, your soil biology, and then your soil physics sometimes. When you're talking about geology, that's just the physical makeup of the soil and the rocks that form the soil. soil chemistry is at a molecular or atomic level, the different elements that are in the soil and how they interact with each other. Soil biology is the life inside the soil. That could be microbiology, like bacteria and fungi, or it could be macrobiology, like soil fauna, things like moles and other large animals that live in the soil. Soil physics is just how the soil usually interacts with water more than anything else. And you're not going to be able to really change the soil physics at all. So geology, chemistry, and biology are the three things that you really have a big hand in. Geology is far and away the most important. You know, you get asked what soil is a lot of the time, and there's really four parts to soil. There is the mineral material, there is the organic matter, there is water, which is partially pore-space, and then there's air, which is partially pore-space. Minerals make up about 45% of the soil. Organic matter makes up about 5%. And then that other half fluctuates between water and air, depending on how wet or dry the weather has been. So if the soil is completely dry, you're going to have 50% air. Air is going to outweigh the mineral matter in your soil. But typically, you can expect about 25% of that pore space to be water and 25% to be air. For the mineral matter, the minerals can be one of three different particles. It can be sand, it can be silt, or it can be clay. And sand and clay don't really need that much explaining. Most people intuitively understand what makes sand sand and what makes clay clay. You know, clay, really sticky, makes the soil much bulkier and denser. Sand has particles that you typically see with the naked eye, very big, very rough, typically. Silt is a little bit harder to intuitively understand until you start thinking of it as the middle child of the soil particles. So it is the one that is not as small as clay and not as big as sand, and it has characteristics when silt dominates the soil that fall in between sand and clay. When I teach this class to kids, because kids actually grasp this soil science concept pretty well, we typically talk about the size of the particles in terms of sand particles are the beach ball, silt particles are the golf ball, and clay particles are the beach. And the size actually makes a huge difference in how your soil is going to interact with water and air. So when you've got sand, sand is the largest particle. It's also the most misshapen particle. So you can't pack very many sand particles close together. There's going to be a lot of open space in between the sand particles for roots to grow down through and water to flow down through. So the more sand that you have in the soil, the better your drainage is going to be and your aeration is going to be. Plant roots are also going to grow through it pretty easily. But the con with really sandy soil is that it dries out very quickly, meaning that you're going to have to do more watering. And most nutrients are going to get washed out with rain or irrigation. So it's going to take more fertilizing on your part. One interesting thing that I found when I was at K-State, I was in a class called plant propagation, which is just responsible for seed germination and basically getting new plants from old plants. We were in a seed germination lab, and we were comparing the growth rate of cucumber seedlings in a standard potting media, so really fluffy, you know, a nice diversity of ingredients, things like perlite, peat moss, cocoa coir. And then we were given that as the control, and we had to make a potting media to compare the control against. And what we were looking at was root growth and shoot growth. So how tall did the seedling grow and how long were their roots? And so we decided to go full chaos and make a comparable potting media as terrible as we possibly could. It was sand, it was rubber, it was perlite. That was it. And shockingly, the roots and shoots of the cucumber seedlings were equally long for both. for the standard potting media and for our terrible potting media that we tried to make as bad as possible. So plants can actually tolerate quite a bit of change or difference in soil texture, but the management on your side, you do need to understand the watering and the nutrient management, depending on how much of each particle is in your soil. For clay, remember we said clay was about the size of a BB, so it is the smallest of the soil particles. That means that a lot of them can pack very close together in the same amount of space it would take for a few sand particles. This means that it does not have a lot of pore space because those particles can pack tighter together. It means the density of your soil is going to be a lot greater. If you've ever tried digging out clay soil, it feels a lot heavier because there's actually physically more mineral matter there. Really the only pro of clayey soil is that it holds water and nutrients in the root zone for plants to use as needed. It does come with a lot of physical cons, but really when it comes to nutrient management, clay is good, but for everything else, clay is not. So your cons are going to be that there is poor vertical drainage downward. It's what's known as wet feet. So if your soil is too clay and it stays wet for too long, it can actually suffocate the roots of plants. Roots need oxygen in order to take up nutrients and water and also to go through respiration. So you definitely don't want to choke your roots out because they will find a way to get their oxygen, and usually that involves coming up to the soil where they interfere with things like lawnmowers. Clay will crust as it dries due to shrink and swell. It compacts very easily when wet, and compaction is the number one thing you want to avoid. It's also pretty hard to work with as a gardener or as a agronomic farmer.
Hey, Jesse, I have a question.
Those are the two main characteristics of the biggest, and silt falls somewhere in the middle. So a good balance of the three soil particles is best because you're going to get good aeration, good drainage, good nutrient retention without over egging the pudding is the way to say it, without leaning too hard into too much drainage or not enough drainage. And so when you have a good balance of those three soil particles in your soil, it's what's called a loam soil, L-O-A-M. Most of our soil is going to lean more towards clay because once you get above 40% clay particles in your soil, then you end up in the full-on either sandy clay, silty clay, or just clay soil. So a little clay goes a long way in your soil. When you have a soil, you have a horizon, and that's because of the way that soil forms, which is known as soil genesis. I'm not going to go too deep into that, but what gardeners know is that soil horizon, the two that you're going to really need to concern yourself with are the O horizon and the A horizon. The A horizon extends down about 10 feet deep, and the O horizon is, depending on how much organic matter there is in your soil, anywhere from 2 feet to 6 inches deep. Some soil is going to have more organic matter than others will, and you can increase the level of your O, or the depth of your O horizon with certain practices that will add organic matter back into the soil. But really, you don't have to think that much about anything below the A horizon, which, again, goes down to 10 feet, unless you're dealing with a plant that has a very long tap root, like a big shade tree. Soils, they layer those below. You have B horizon and D horizon, and then, or C horizon, and then D horizon is the bedrock from which soil forms. So when you have bedrock, it goes through weathering. And weathering is the physical breakdown of the rock into soil. It is also the chemical breakdown of the rock into soil. So that breakdown is very, very important for us in terms of pH. And I'll talk about pH. One of my favorite things to talk about when talking about soil science is that a lot of people, and this was probably my favorite thing that I learned all throughout K-State. The USDA actually has taxonomy for soils, like biologists have taxonomy for animals and plants. So there's different species of soils based on their characteristics. But there are 12, like, you know how taxonomy goes, kingdom, phylum, order, class, or kingdom, phylum, class, order,
family, genus, species.
Right. Yeah, so the USDA has 12 different orders of soils. Our order that we have most commonly in Kansas is called a mollisol. The order can be thought of kind of like family in the standard taxonomy. And then from there you get more specific into like a type of soil that functions like a species, but that is usually going to take like use of the Webb Soil Survey on the USDA website. But that's just a fun fact most people don't think about because, you know, soil is alive, but soil mineral matter is not alive. Classifying it in the same way as we would classify living organisms feels weird at first, but it's fun to think about. When you have soil and you have particles, sometimes the soil will form what's known as aggregates. That is an overly scholarly term for it. Most people will just call them clods. There's two components of soil that encourage aggregation. The first is the cohesion of the clay, and the second is the amount of organic matter in your soil, specifically humus. Certain cultural practices will destroy aggregation. The first is relying too much on tillage. For large farms, I understand the need to till. For smaller gardens, I would far and away recommend not tilling because the compaction that you're going to accidentally introduce when you till, either through the tillage pan or through, mostly through the tillage pan, is not going to be worth the marginal benefits that you get from tilling and reduced labor. For larger farms, like agronomic crops, soybeans, wheat, corn, I understand the appeal of tilling. I would definitely encourage any farmers to look for ways to reduce their tillage because that will reduce erosion. It will reduce that compaction that you're going to have to deal with in the future as well. But it's definitely more understandable on that large scale. The other cultural practice that will destroy aggregation is irrigating with poor quality water. So when you have water that is high in sodium, that will disperse aggregates and make your soil a soupy mess. You can also see minor aggregation dispersal with water that is high in salt. And when we're talking about salt from a chemical perspective, it's not just sodium, it's ionic elements that will end up in the soil through poor quality water. That's going to result in a saline soil, whereas sodium specifically, if you end up with too much, that's going to result in a sodic soil. The sodic soil is absolutely what you want to prevent getting into your soil. But that takes me to pH. And I probably did not save enough time for pH unless I can go a little bit late, because soil pH is the single most important chemical, really the single most important management that you're going to have for your soil. In terms of making sure that the soil fertility for your plants or the nutrients that are available in the soil for your plants is where it needs to be. Am I good to go a little bit over 8:30 on this?
Yeah, we can go a little bit further. And James, did you have a question earlier?
Yeah, so let's say a gardener has some access to some pond clean out, like, you know, the sludge at the bottom of a pond that this time of year, especially because it's been dry, we've had a lot of pond clean-out sludge. Would that be very good stuff to put on your garden? What can you do with that?
Well, when you're adding something to your garden, you want to make sure you're not bringing in any potential diseases. And I would say I honestly don't know. I have not gotten this question. My gut is telling me that that would actually be pretty good soil. You do need to keep in mind that erosion is typically going to be the smaller particles, the smaller soil particles like silt and clay. So it might create a texture issue, and that's something you would be able to tell as you saw the soil at the bottom of what was pond, like sludge cleanout. To my knowledge, I don't think there would be any problems with that, but I am not 100% sure on that. I will be doing some more research on that today, I suppose. But yeah, no. I can't think of any reason why it wouldn't be okay to use if you wanted to.
I mean, I was leading you on that question.
Sorry, but... I don't have a
better question. You're welcome, Jesse.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean... And so pond clean out, it's, as you would imagine, because it's erosion, it is mostly clay. There can be some silt and sand in there. But the problem with it is high in phosphorus and potassium. That's good. And usually quite a bit of organics because they don't break down in that anaerobic environment. The problem is that it has no aggregation to it. So people that add it to their gardens, they need to do so sparingly. Because if you add too much of it, its complete lack of aggregation is going to form a terrible crust in your garden. The same thing with your fields, like, you know, the river wash out when the Neosho floods. It's very crusty, and it has zero aggregation to it. So you can add it, but you have to add it very sparingly. Almost, I don't know, not more than half an inch at a time, and you got to stir that in to incorporate it into the whole profile. Otherwise, you're just going to end up with a real crusty mess if you add too much of that stuff.
Yeah, and it's definitely not something that I would want to add to an already clean soil. So my intuition about the erosion was at least right.
Yeah.
Awesome. So, yeah, you definitely want to take stock of your current soil and figure out what your texture is so you're not adding clay to. Okay, so real quick, pH. I am going to try and speed through this. I will be answering, well, if you have any questions about this topic or want me to go into more detail, you can always call our office. But pH, it is a scale that measures the acidity or the alkalinity of a soil. When you think of pH, what you can think of is water. When water breaks down, you have ions. Ions are charged particles that really, really do not want to be charged. They want to bond with particles of opposite charge in order to cancel their charge out and become neutral. So you have water, or H2O, that is a neutral molecule. There is no charge because the two hydrogens add one positive charge each, and the oxygen adds two negative charges. When that breaks apart, you have one positively charged hydrogen ion, and you have one negatively charged hydroxide molecule. Acidity is when you have more charged hydrogen in the soil than you have hydroxide, and alkalinity is when you have more charged hydroxide than you have hydrogen. 7 is neutral, that is when they are present in equal quantity. The charge on hydrogen and hydroxide determine all of the soil's nutrient characteristics because all of the soil nutrients will also be ions. And so they will want to bond to either the hydrogen or the hydroxide depending on what the charge of the nutrient is. And if you have too much hydrogen and your negatively charged nutrients are typically going to be bound up and not available to the plant. If you have too much hydroxide, all of your positively charged nutrients are going to be bound up and not available to the plant. You do have the option of adjusting your soil pH to make the pH go down or to become more acidic. You could apply a sulfur or an ammonium-based fertilizer. to make it go up and make the soil more alkaline, you would need to apply ag lime. Lime is calcium carbonate. The carbonate is negatively charged, and when lime breaks down, you get the calcium and you get the carbonate. So calcium in most of our soils should not be deficient. We still see problems like blossom end rot, which is actually a sign of calcium deficiency in tomatoes. That's not because the calcium isn't there. It's usually because pH is making it unavailable. I will say 99 times out of 100, you will not need to add any lime to make the pH go up. Really, the only times we are going to see overly acidic soils is when you deal with some kind of industrial contamination. Our parent material is bedrock. Our parent material is limestone. Limestone is the bedrock from which our soil forms in Kansas. And when the bedrock breaks down, the soil that forms from it is going to have the same chemical properties as the rock does. So we said limestone was calcium carbonate. When it weathers, chemically, it becomes calcium and carbonate. Calcium has a +2 charge to its ion. Carbonate has a -2 charge to its ion. So when carbonate, with its -2, is present in a soil with positively charged hydrogen, two of those hydrogen ions are going to bond with the carbonate. And because the amount of free hydrogen in the soil is reduced, we are saying that the soil is becoming more alkaline. Our natural soil pH is between 7 and 8. I have seen it get up as high as 8.4. For the purposes of horticulture, most plants are going to want a pH in between 6 and 7. And a difference between 6 and 7 doesn't sound like a lot, but pH is actually a logarithmic scale. So there's actually 10 times more hydrogen ions in the soil of a 6 pH soil than there is in a 7 pH soil. So definitely getting a soil test done will tell you where your pH is at if you're experiencing nutrient deficiencies. We say 6 and 7 because that's the sweet spot for most of the micronutrients. Because hydroxide is so present in our soil, that's going to bond with a lot of the positively charged nutrients and make them unavailable for the plant to take up. So that's going to be your iron, that's going to be your manganese, that's going to be your copper and zinc, and that's going to be your boron. The ones that I have seen the most in terms of deficiency are iron, manganese, and, iron and manganese are the two that I see the most. So if you are seeing nutrient deficiencies that are not nitrogen, phosphorus, or potassium, do a soil sample. It is absolutely worth figuring out what your pH is, because that's probably what you need to change and not necessarily the amount of fertilizer in your soil.
All right, Jesse. Well, we do appreciate that in-depth little kind of crash course and all this. And if people do have questions for you, where can they find you? What's the best way to get a hold of you?
They can call one of our offices. My main office is 620-724-8233. And my email address is jr637@ksu.edu.
All righty, good deal. And then, James, if people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to get in touch with you? And can you run through our upcoming event one more time, too?
Yeah, so same office, 620-724-8233. I have my agronomy night trivia on December the 5th. It's going to be super fun. Wendy's, she's going to have her limited cattle feeding and other winter things. That'll be on November 14th in Girard. And Holly, she's going to have some surf safe certification stuff also in Crawford County coming up here pretty soon too.
Okay, and now speaking of trivia, I have a question for both of you. So hopefully you know it. What is the state soil of Kansas?
Harney silt loam.
Yeah, I knew it. Good job, Jesse. Hey. He's like, oh no, I know that.
That's good job. Yeah, I learned that in geography of Kansas. So. All right, good job. You win the prize, Jesse. All righty. Well, thank you guys both for coming in. Real pleasure, and look forward to chatting again here real soon.
Thanks.
And we got open line. Yep, you take care. Got open line on the way here on KGGF.